Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
The next guest is Matthew Bowerman. He's always sought out to serve others. His career in education has spanned over 23 years, teaching in middle and high school as a theater, special education, English, and reading teacher. He is a recipient of an Emmy Award, as well as a Cine Golden Eagle Film Award for writing, directing the educational short, Bus Stop, addressing the bullying crisis in the United States. He is also a Maryland Gifted and Talented Leadership Awardee and PSTA Lifetime Award recipient. In addition, Matthew is also the family liaison chair, as well as a writer for the Say Their Names Memorial. Matthew's deeply invested in the work of Love Leading Students and Their Families in his current role as school administrator in the Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland. He is currently working on his upcoming book, Heart Leader. Welcome to the podcast, Matthew.
Hi, thank you so much, Dr. Goody. I really appreciate it.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
I feel like after so many years in education, we're constantly climbing in and out of trenches, over walls, through them, around them in some way or another. It always feels like some form of a trench engagement. I am thinking about a really specific time, September 11th, mm-hmm. The fall of the towers in New York. And I was teaching, I was working in high school, a theater class, my whole theater ensemble. I was working with my students. And, you know, just like often things happen in school, there were some rumors or some gossip. There was some some noise that had drifted down from the main office and reached our halls about something that happened, and to turn on the television. And I had a class, I think, of juniors and seniors with me in the room. And we turned it on. It was just after the first tower had been hit. And we witnessed that, as well as the second tower. When that happened, I had lived and worked in New York for many years as a performer, and also had a lot of friends and family there and surrounding areas, as did some of my students. And they were very curious, obviously very concerned. And we were just, a part of that, embedded in that moment together. We did a lot of reflective journaling and work in our acting kind of notebook script books in the classroom. And so I had told them to sit down and, as we're trying to process what we were seeing and what was going on, if they wanted to write or reflect in those moments. But a little while later, after we had turned the TV off, we sat together, we held each other, we held hands, we just kind of sat and, I guess you could say, meditated, prayed, reflected. And I was just there with them. We were there in our anxiety about it, there in our sadness, there in our fear and worry, all of us collectively sharing this experience. No one ever, any different. It made no difference that, there are, degrees attached to me, or that they're, 16, 17, 18 years old. All that distance was bridged, very easily, not only in the relationships we already had, but in the moment that we needed each other in that trench. We needed each other in the middle of that battle. Everybody was kind of engaging in their own way with what we had seen, what we had heard, what we had witnessed, what we were thinking and feeling, and trying to help them in a gentle and loving way deal with their grief, deal with their questions, their concerns, as well as trying to manage my own, just put us in a very vulnerable and human space together. And we had this daily kind of beautiful opportunity to create together in the theater, work we were doing, and making art and celebrating it and collaborating. But in this way, we're just very much, linked around this emotional collaboration, where we're trying to find ways to support each other, to share love, to listen, to bounce ideas, and to kind of make it through this day that we were a part of. And so that was a really powerful, a really obviously sad and troubling day to work through, but it really spoke to how critical as an educator it is to build deep relationships, to create authentic and loving connections with students, because when all these other things come along and kind of earthquake the world around you, you can rely on those relationships to support, to see you through the other side, kind of all those trenches. And it certainly helped us in those trenches we were in that day. It certainly helped us in our emotions. It certainly helped us in our questions and thoughts and feelings. You know, all these years later, that particular class, frequently each year at the memorial time, we will send a message out online or whatnot. I was there with you. I remember. And that impact still resonates to this day, how we made it out of that trench and carry forward and still carry those memories, those stories, and I guess most importantly, those connections with us.
Yeah. And it's so, impactful that you remember that from, over 20 years ago, and just kind of what you all did and, you know, the relationships you'd built with that drama class and just being able to, you know, grieve together, right? Nobody knew what to do, right? At that time. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's inspired some of the work that you're doing currently. Let's talk a little bit about your upcoming book. So Heart Leader, you said, is currently in the editor's hands. So maybe it will be out at the end of 2021, maybe early 2022. Tell me a little bit about what this book is about and what inspired you to write it.
Sure, certainly. Thank you. I'm really grateful to Codebreaker and Brian Aspinall and Daphne McMenemy, who really have given me the chance to believe in me to carry this story forward. I've been working on it, you know, as an educator in administration and leadership on this end of things as a school administrator. And then on the tail end of my teaching work, probably for about 5 years or so, maybe about 6 years, I've been collecting anecdotal kind of stories, student data, parent data, community data for years around the idea that I wanted to shape a book at some point with stories around engagement, around leadership, around working through difficult times as an educator. And so in the last few years, it's really taken shape in my work. Now that I'm deeply engaged in around family and student engagement, around trauma-informed care, culturally responsive work from a trauma-informed lens, and a lot of restorative justice and social emotional work. And so the book, Heart Leader, I've always been one of those men, husbands, fathers, and educators that people always said, you wear your heart on your sleeve. I am very hypersensitive and hyper-emotional. And that I think has always been connected back to my own origins, my own trauma stories as well. But it's also helped shape and mold me into the place where I am now in terms of how I approach education and approach prioritizing staff wellness and student and family wellness and engagement. But the book really now has come out of that place, and it's kind of a K-12 field guide. It's part memoir, part kind of field guide with actionable tips throughout. And it really is about the concept I've kind of come up with, you know, because I've gone with this moniker, this title for myself, the Heart Leader. Someone had said to me once, you're always about leading from the heart. You're always about love. When working with the kids, and it was like click light bulb, that has to be it. And so it's really about intentionally living out a message of love in not only like theory and in philosophy, but in practical applications that you can impact student achievement. You can truly impact wellness and social emotional health for students and families by leading from a love lens. And it's about that compassionate guidance. I'm helping them to manifest that in themselves, constantly and consistently advocating for a belief that kids come first every day. And it's all about authentic relationships in every interaction. And that's a very challenging thing for us as educators, because we're tasked with so much and there's just so many heavy lifts. But really identifying in yourself, authentic you, realistic you, all the time, and then living from that place with how you interact with other people in a school community, And that authentic work really, I think, for me, engenders authentic love. And so that's what the book traces and then provides. It's all about heart leading in a time of loss and hope. Mm-hmm. It's all about prioritizing staff wellness and how to heart lead prioritizing staff with all they're dealing with. And like I said, it's part memoir. It examines my journey through trauma and my journey to now where I am, and the mentor who helped shape my journey. And then the future work of education and what that really requires in terms of actionable strategies to prioritize love leading as the key to real success in schools.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It sounds like a very timely book.
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking so much about self-care, not only for, the social emotional needs of children, but also for our staff and for leaders. So definitely, I'll share this out when the podcast episode is released, and it should coincide pretty closely to the book coming out, and making sure that, I get share out the importance of reading this type of book. And, I talked to you in the pre-chat a little bit about, I wanted to highlight, so I said in the bio, so you had won an Emmy. So you said it was back in the mid 2000s, you and your students made a educational short, A Bus Stop. So tell me a little bit about the process of making that short film.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you. I was working as a teacher. I was in a department chair in a performing arts high school, teaching all different types of theater and movement and dance work and all those types of things. I had an amazing ensemble of young student artists who were eager to take risks, eager to try things. We were all kind of creating work. And I was also working for the Education Channel for the Baltimore County Public School System. And I was writing content for them around bullying and cyberbullying. And I put a piece together called Bus Stop, B-U-S, lowercase bus, and then stop in capital letters, kind of a play on words with the whole notion of a bus stop, but what often happens on buses in terms of teasing, harassment, bullying, violence, and how it's kind of this, a bus almost becomes a self-contained microcosm, like for school communities on the daily, and the different things that can occur there. And so I wrote a short piece. It's maybe, four and a half minutes. My students, rather than cast it from other, actors outside of it, it was a great opportunity for my students. They really wanted to be a part of it. The Education Channel, supported it from that end in terms of some direction, their editing and film work. I had written the piece and co-directed it with a colleague of mine, Jeff Lifton, wonderful media specialist as well. He and I both won Emmys for it. We put this piece together, which was about a situation where a child, engaging in playing with a toy on the bus, and some other kids notice him, for how he looks and what he's doing. And they kind of target it and lock in and decide through kind of a little bit of some mob mentality that they're going to start to question and antagonize and tease him. It leads to then taking it away from him and then threatening him as well. And then how, in those moments, it's like everything freezes, everything locks down within those kind of captured landscapes of violence, and what happens around them. All these other children are exposed to that trauma. They're witnesses to it. And so the piece is also on the bus stop. There's this notion of to speak out against that injustice, that there has to be witnesses, not only to bear witness, but to act in some way. And so children on the bus, speaking direct address to the camera, stand up and say, no, stop. And then they begin to provide information, statistical information, anecdotal information, personal information about the nature of violence toward other children, about the nature of bullying, and how it takes, a community to put an end to these things, to give voice to them, and then to shut them down and to help stop those things from continuing to perpetuate, since we know that the bullying crisis has continued to poison education in this country and internationally as well. And so when I finished the piece, we were really proud of it. I didn't even know it was submitted. The Education Channel submitted it to the Cine Company and to the Emmy Awards. And like I said, it was up against.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
Children and the education, you know, to make all that end, to put an end to all of it.
And is this a film available on any type of medium that people can access?
I haven't put it out like publicly. At some point, I'll probably upload it to my website, but I have never, you know, honestly, in the past, people have asked, oh, yeah, here's a DVD copy of it. Right now, it's in a box of some of my other films here at home. And that's kind of where it's lived since then. But I'll probably put it up at some point this year just to share, because some other people have asked about being interested just in seeing it. And while it's, you know, it happened in 2008, I think the concepts are still universal. The needs for children are still universal. The outcry of looking for help and support is still universal, and that we need, you know, educators, you know, fully engaged in vigilant, you know, safeguarding of children in school communities around this issue.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your transformation coming from the classroom to school leadership. Did you have any type of aha moment?
I feel like I'm kind of in like a constant aha. It just kind of extended, just kind of drifts through the years in this big aha.
Yeah.
I've been I guess excuse me. I've team leader, department chair, content specialist, leadership positions, and then I was a middle school assistant principal for about a half year, and then 4 years now as an elementary school assistant principal. I think, you know, not to sound like probably many other people, but the pandemic, I think, has exposed and continue to expose so much disproportionality data around our communities of color, and how historically, I'll just use this country, how historically those communities and indigenous communities have been marginalized and disenfranchised by education systems, whether it be with materials distribution, resources, money attached to supporting for just classrooms in general. And there are a tremendous amount of educators out there fighting in anti-racist, equity-based ways against all of that. But there is so much of the system that's been, you know, designed to ostracize communities of color and indigenous communities. And so the pandemic, in laying so much bare, it wasn't that I didn't know, because I'm embedded in that work. I'd like to think deeply all the time, and have been throughout my career and then also in my personal life. But it showed me just how many people were arms out, hands out, reaching out, saying, we need more. We are really struggling because the history, the systems have left us in a place where we need more in these time periods. You know, you see others, in some cases, other schools, other districts, other communities who have money, extra things, resources, et cetera, to support during that time. Our school in some cases didn't have that. And so the ahas were, this is a chance for me and other colleagues that I work with to kind of elevate their needs, their voices to a higher level and amplify our responses to that engagement work, those distributions for whatever it might be, groceries, clothing, toys, monetary needs, to amplify our work with our community partners and our in-house partners from our wellness teams at a much deeper, more robust level that really put us in the houses with families, at their front doors, at their doorsteps, at their dinner tables, you know, really talking on a different level, having deeper conversation with just even more honest language about the struggles of people during this time, and then trying to find ways to really answer those calls, to answer those requests, and try to meet those needs as best as myself and my colleagues were able to. So it's really been an aha and then a constant reminder, I think, not only of my own privilege and what I live with and carry as a white male administrator, but, you know, the responsibility I have as an administrator at this level to not only students and staff, but to the families we represent and serve, that this time period and the crises of race and the crises of COVID are not going away anytime soon, and that we have to continue to think about and then operationalize at a level that really focuses on the human factor and their stories. So that's been a really helpful, really powerful, a constant aha, I think, for me.
Yeah, and I really think that puts it in the context of how we are servant leaders in this field, right? And whether it be, you know, making sure yes. there's enough food to go around when a lot of people were unemployed at the onset of the pandemic, to, you know, just following up and making sure, you know, they have resources such as coats when we're coming up on winter, and, you know, working with communities. That's always been one of my passion pieces as well. But yeah, I could see how, yeah, it is a constant aha when you're learning more about the families, right? You're learning more about just plugging in that trauma-informed piece. And, you know, it's every day's something new in leadership.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're in the people business. You know, we can never forget that for a single moment.
Mm-hmm. So you have a blog. Is this something that you write often? And what kind of writing do you do on your blog?
Thanks for asking. So currently, I think it's kind of things I'm working on. So I have maybe five or six that are on there that capture moments from my class, some of my classroom experiences, mm-hmm. some of my work with students previously or currently. I have several other pieces I'm going to be adding there. I'm also engaged in a bunch of other writing right now for other books and publications. And so that's kind of taken a chunk of my writing time. I'm working also for Dr. Byron McClure, who does lessons for SEL online and has an amazing site there. And I've been writing content for him on social emotional work and engagement. And so I've been kind of wrapped up there. But the blog, the intention is to continue to practice my craft and development around the work that I do as a leader, and then to share it out there. I need to continue to put some more of my writing there, but it really focuses on my experiences as a leader. There's some other pieces there too that have shaped my leadership. Mm-hmm. For example, during the pandemic, I lost one of my brothers, my youngest brother, and then two of my cousins as well to substance abuse and whatnot. And I have a piece about that as well, because, you know, the opioid crisis and what that has done nationwide and worldwide to families has been tremendous. And while I've been touched by that, I have many families that I support and work with that are touched by those types of things as well. And just trying to reflect, you know, constantly, you know, reflecting on self and trying to, for me, at least me personally, mindfully and intentionally refine myself and evolve. Mm-hmm. Within the nature of the communities I serve and their stories as well, and finding those connections really helps me, I feel like, to serve better. And so I think a lot of my writing is about that. Here are the things that happened or that were going on. Here are the things that I did in those moments strategically. Here are the mistakes I made. Mm-hmm. Here was the impact it had. And here's what I think now, like looking back on it as a leader reflectively. That's kind of where my blogs kind of live.
Yeah, and that's a great piece to kind of follow what, you know, leading from that event, whatever the event you're writing about is, and then seeing how it impacts your work and, you know, reflecting on that and putting that out there just for other leaders to resonate with, right? That they're able to maybe take something from what you've experienced and connect with their own work.
I hope. I really hope so, because none of this exists in a vacuum. And so I think we, you know, in this field, in this service, what we're called to, you know, must have one another. That's the only, I'm never the smartest person in the room. And always try to surround myself with people who have greater skills than me or other things to offer. And I think, you know, opportunities to collaborate with you like this and other things like this allow so many of us to connect, to listen to one another, and to help shape our work reflectively from the lessons that we're all kind of, you know, providing and sharing, you know, sharing with one another.
I also wanted to talk about some of the professional speaking you do. On your website, you have several sessions and trainings highlighted. For example, you have a Dismantling White Privilege, Building Allies and Accomplices, Dear White Leaders, and Getting Real with Mindfulness and Leadership. Can you talk a little bit about some of these trainings and what the goal is if you were brought in to a school to give one of these trainings, or maybe an experience that you have having been at a school and given one of these trainings?
Certainly. So the first two that deal with privilege, white privilege, that deal with anti-racism, cultural responsive behavior, and equity are pieces that I'd like to share with the larger educational communities, you know, nationwide or beyond that. They haven't lived anywhere beyond my last couple schools in one form or another, in small group or, you know, school-based, I guess, leadership moments. And some pieces that I've written that have extended that work. Some of that work as directed to those speaking opportunities also is attached to my work with the Say Their Names Memorial. Mm-hmm. And that's a group of activists, writers, and researchers who meet with and interview families of color and Indigenous families nationwide and capture their stories of a loved one who's been killed at the hands of law enforcement or had some other race-related thing happen to them and lost that family member. And we interviewed them, we capture those stories. And then those stories go around in traveling memorial exhibits all around the country. Now, I'm the family liaison chair for the organization, so I have met with many families who have sat with me and trusted me to caretake with them and shape those stories, write them, and then carry them forward into these memorials. And so it's helped to constantly, I think, reflect for me as a leader on me as a male, as a white male, as a white heterosexual male, and as a leader carrying my work forward, and most of my work, a lot of it's always been in Title I communities, working fortunately with many communities of color and Indigenous families. I have my own mixed background as well that I'm grateful for. It all kind of wraps up in the sense of trying to find ways to identify my whiteness as a tool for shaping productive and positive anti-racist behavior moving forward, and trying to help advocate and inspire other leaders. But there's no great white hope going on here. Mm-hmm. I'm just another person who's an ally who believes in these things and takes that belief and puts it into action, hopefully in very authentic and loving and compassionate and at times really strong ways to let people know what I'm willing, you know, what I'm unwilling to compromise in the work of anti-racism, and then in carrying that forward to try to help other white leaders who are out there in positions like this to be seen, to be perceived as people who are truly supportive of deconstructing and dismantling racist systems, who are not just allies anymore, but move from ally to accomplice and are really a part of actual deconstruction and then rebuilding, who are actually part of aggressive activism, who are actually a part of legislation and out in the streets work, or whatever it is that they're at their levels of comfort to really build new platforms to support communities of color and Indigenous communities in educational systems, in educational communities nationwide, that are really culturally responsive and truly equitable. And so that's kind of where those particular speaking engagements are kind of coming from, based on my journey, and then reflection and actionable strategies for people moving forward. The other piece is really about my work. The mindfulness and leadership piece is really all about finding ways to prioritize staff. We do a lot of great work nationwide for students around self-care, mindfulness. There's a lot of different terms for it, but we're still really working, I think, in its infancy in some ways, on really prioritizing staff wellness to really connect with what's affecting staff, what they need to be healthy, to be happy, to be successful, and to thrive in school communities when they've been burdened with so much trauma in the last few years, and probably even before that, with so many things they have to juggle and so many hats they have to wear. And so finding ways to operationalize this concept of mindfulness in a school, it's not just all about yoga or meditation, because some people hear those things and they shut off right away. Mm-hmm. They don't want to have anything to do with that. And while those are beautiful tools, very successful tools in some communities with students and with school staff, they're not the only tools. There are many other reflective practices, scholarly literature-based practices, simple breath work-based things that can happen that can be used to give staff time and space to release energy, to release emotion, to have a voice in a different kind of way that's more, I guess, emotionally, we could even say spiritually, quote unquote, driven, that takes them away from all of the task-based things that they're weighed with. Mm-hmm. And that they know that in that school day or in that school week that they have administration and other staff that they can come together with and release some of that and step away from, like I mentioned, the everyday tasks and look within and reflect and process and breathe and kind of open up and get to a much cleaner and clearer and mentally healthy place to engage with the rest of their week or the rest of their month or the rest of their year in a way that feels socially, emotionally successful for them, and that they know that there are support systems in place to help guide them. So that piece is all about that, as well as how schools can shape that work and how administrators can support that and provide space and time for that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I really like how you point out that, yeah, yoga and meditation is not the only piece to, right. Having a balanced staff, as I would say, right? It's simple as breathing exercise, as simple as just connecting them with inner selves and energy, having exploration of how they react to different things. So yeah, definitely. We'll talk about where people can find you when we end, and they can visit your website for more information on those offerings. Well out of everything we talked about on the podcast, what's one thing you'd like listeners to remember?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think I would say it's a universal thing that they can carry anywhere. It's not just in a school classroom. It's not just in a cafeteria or outside of the arrival or dismissal. It exists everywhere, from the grocery store to the classroom, from the neighborhood park, to the community meeting down the street. And in the end, it's all about authentic relationships and all about authentic love. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That is kind of my heart leader motto and message. And from when you wake up to when you go to sleep at night, I mean, I need to be able to lay down at night and know that I've tried, and please know I fail all the time and make myriad mistakes around it, but I try to be the best leader, father, husband, human being that I can be, and often fall short of that, but it's all about that productive struggle. I'm constantly trying to do that. I'm constantly trying to find that in myself based on my work on self and with others. So it's really all about authentic relationships and authentic love for self and for others.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great to end with. And where can people find you online and connect with you?
Thank you. I'd love to hear from people. You can follow me at Twitter. Join me there. Let's make a connection. It's at capital MJ, capital B for Bowerman, MJ Bowerman on Twitter. My website, you're welcome to come there anytime and reach out to me through my email platform there at www.MatthewJBowerman.com. It's all lowercase. My email is MatthewJBowerman@gmail.com. Anytime you have a question or need something we can collaborate on or problem solve with, I'm out here in the universe ready to support and share the love back.
Great. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the Out of the Trenches podcast today.
I'm honored. Thank you so much, Dr. Goodyear. I really appreciate the opportunity to connect.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, and if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.